Well, the Football World Cup is reaching fever pitch. There are only four teams left in the tournament. If you're even vaguely following events, you'll know that SBS Sports editorial chief, well, face of football, Les Murray, is firmly anchoring the coverage from South Africa. It's a good chance to again background the man who calls himself a victim of soccer's seductive powers, a man bitten by the game as a young boy who says it's fueled and sustained him. He came to Australia as a refugee known as Laszlo Urge, and by his mid-teens he was determined to alter the sporting mindset of Australians. Les Murray was born in Hungary when it was part of the Soviet Empire. His family left when he was 10 years old. This extended conversation begins with Les talking about his memories of childhood there.
Well, the family lived. I've got two brothers and my parents. We lived in a place called Budakeszi, which is on the outskirts of Budapest. It's now just about part of Budapest because of the expansion. But it was a small village then, and it was a fairly Spartan existence by what Australians would call standards. We were poor. Everybody in Hungary was poor. Hungary was oppressed by Stalinism. Hungary was on the losing side of the war, so it was under all those effects. But as a kid, I mean, we didn't mind that. You know, kids are kids. They accept what is and what they're given. They don't really know what more they could have. I do remember that even as a small child, the political oppression. I do remember that my parents could not say out loud what they felt about certain things, particularly politics.
Yes.
And they talked forever about one day, if things don't change, going west and create a better life.
I want to get on to that later because, of course, that's exactly what happened. But football, when did that love affair begin?
It began very early. Maybe I was about 7 or 8 years old. I can't remember how old I was. But my father took me to a game, a local village game. And I was just mesmerized by this game, how these guys could manipulate a football with their feet the way you are born to manipulate it with your hands. That grabbed me for a start. I'd never seen that before. And I just loved the geometry of the game and the creativity of the game and all of that. So the interesting thing about that is that most people, get the football bug either by their parents, by their father or their mother, telling them who to support. I'm a Liverpool fan, so therefore you're a Liverpool
fan.
Or they see some big game somewhere. Their father takes them to a game like Fever Pitch. Nick Hornby was taken by his father to an Arsenal game at Highbury. So he was mesmerised by the big occasion, the big atmosphere.
Big stadium.
That's right. But I was not. There was a few hundred fans there. It was a purely amateur game. I was mesmerized. I was smitten by the purest essence of the game, if you like. The other stuff came later, the more glamorous side and the more spectacular side of it.
But you were also, on that very first occasion, captured by the tribalism, that there's an us and there's a them.
That too, absolutely. I mean, instinctively, I knew which was my team. So I rooted for them and I thought the referee was biased and all those things that football fans naturally experience.
Don't have to be taught, just know how.
No, it's purely instinctive, yeah.
But at the same time, while this was happening, you didn't have your own football. In fact, you didn't even really know anybody who had their own football.
No, I didn't see a leather ball until years later. And what we did, my two brothers and I and other kids in the area, we would play football with a ball, tennis ball, in the backyard or in the street. Basically until dark, that was our playtime.
Still, it's a very good basis for things like close control and touch, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, all the great players of the world were educated in the street, whether it was Pelé or Maradona or even Ronaldinho today. Organized football was not, in those days certainly, organized football was not something that was responsible for players becoming good players.
Now, football was hugely important for Hungary at the time. Just remind us about this great Hungarian team and its amazing run of success.
Well, it was born out of the communist regime's need to fuel the people.
And some very, very talented individuals, it has to be said.
Well, very, very talented. But Hungary always had a great tradition in football. So, you know, I'm going back to the 30s and the 1920s. They were producing great players and great teams. They were runners-up in the 1938 World Cup, for example. But what happened in the 1950s under Stalinism is the big propaganda thing of selling the utopia of communism to the rest of the world. So the regime decided to assist building a good national team. And they did that by basically forcibly transferring players to two clubs so that there could be week in and week out unity and cohesion between the players. The clubs played on the Saturday or the Sunday, and then midweek on Wednesday, the national team every week would gather together and go down into the country somewhere, to some country town, and play a game against the local 11.
Slaughter them,
of course, win 11-12-0 in front of 15, 16,000 fans. And they built this unity, they built this winning habit and this happy kind of family thing. And this team became probably the greatest football team of all time. In terms of their record, they went 4 years undefeated, 30-something games unbeaten. They beat England at Wembley at 6-3, and they beat them 7-1 at home, and made the World Cup final, but they lost that, but that's another story.
I want to get onto that. This is the magical Magyars.
The golden team, yeah, as the Hungarians called them, led by Ferenc Puskás, who was the greatest player in the world at that time. But what this did to the Hungarian people was to distract them from their misery, from their poverty, from the fact that, you know, they had to queue up for a loaf of bread, that there was political oppression, no freedom of speech, all those things that they were miserable about.
So it's not uncoincidental then that in 1954 they get to the World Cup final. Everybody expects them to win except for West Germany,
yes,
who spoil the party.
Yes.
And it's not long after that, of course, that we have the Hungarian uprising.
That's correct. My thesis in the book is that that defeat indirectly led to the uprising 2 years later. The people were angry. They were very angry and they were very depressed. And they saw that not all was well in the world of the worker state, including the fact that it couldn't deliver the trophy. And that, I think, triggered a mood and a restlessness, which ultimately led to the uprising in 1956.
The other thing that happened, of course, was that Stalin had died and Khrushchev delivers the speech in which he damns some elements of Stalinism, and that probably emboldened some people.
It did. I mean, when that happened, I remember my parents listening to the news on the radio about Khrushchev delivering this speech in which he criticised his predecessors under Stalin. That was unheard of, that any major political leader in the communist world would criticise anything within communism.
So it took off in Budapest. Now, what stands did your family take?
Well, my parents were, of course, anti-regime, anti-Soviet, anti-communists. They were both of a bourgeois background. They suffered to some extent because of communism. My father couldn't get a decent job because of that. So they were anti, and I mean, basically, I mean, everybody was anti. There was no freedom of speech. There was nothing that you could rejoice in about this utopian communism. So when the revolution broke out, they were obviously very excited and took it as a great piece of news.
But when it was crushed, when the Red Army came in and crushed it, there were obviously then potential for reprisals for the people who'd supported.
Well, there was, and my father was quite active. He wasn't an active fighter in the revolution, but he was he made a lot of noises and attended a lot of rallies and demonstrations and all sorts of things. So in the little enclave where we lived, this kind of apartment housing estate, he was well known as a proponent of the uprising and a proponent of regime change. He would have been in serious trouble had we stayed in Hungary after the revolution was crushed.
This obviously had a major input into your parents' decision to leave the country. Tell me about the escape.
Well, my parents had been talking about doing this for a long time, but before the revolution broke out, it was impossible. The borders were so tightly closed with electric wire fences and mines and all sorts of things. So you were literally taking your life in your hands if you tried to break out. But once the revolution broke out and had been won, because the revolution was won for a number of days, all those border fences came down. So in that sense, it was possible to escape. But by the time the tanks rolled in and crushed the revolution, they closed the borders again. They didn't put the fences up because there was no time, basically, or any of that stuff. So in the middle of one night, winter's night in early December of 1956, my mother woke us up, my brothers and I, and at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and said, get dressed, we're going. And I said, well, going where? It's too early for school. She said, never mind, just get dressed, we're going. There was no packing, there was nothing. We just had the clothes on our back. Maybe my mother had a handbag with her or something, and that was it. And we were hauled on the back of a truck, and then driven to one of the main railway stations of Budapest, took a train to the border, and then through various obstacle courses, we made it west. But it was brilliantly planned by my parents, and we had no idea. It was unbelievable how they did this.
You're dressing like peasants to attend a wedding at one point, aren't
you? Exactly. Well, the pretense under which we left, in case we were stopped questioned by the police or the secret police.
And that did happen, too.
It did happen. Was that we were going to a cousin's wedding in a small village in Western Hungary near the Austrian border. And we had to dress up. Well, certainly my mother had to, because my mother was a very slick, chic city woman. She didn't look anything like a country woman. So she had to change her attire. And
dress
in fact,
down.
I remember one collaborator telling her to get some soap and water and wash that rouge and that lipstick off her face, you know.
You had help along the way, didn't you?
Yes.
There were collaborators
yes.
at every point
yes,
who were paid.
Who were paid. I mean, very small amount because my parents didn't have very much. But obviously they were service providers. And the main intermediaries in this was a peasant family in a small village near the border, who ultimately led us across the border. They were being paid for this service, because otherwise we would have got lost and we would have got caught and we would have been turned back. So, and I do make this point in the book, that these people, which we now call very darkly people traffickers, who are demonized by most of us, are in fact very, very necessary in the process of defection, in the process of being a refugee, of quests for freedom.
Mm.
How would you go if you wanted to escape tyranny and you had no way of getting to the other side without help? You know, you couldn't do it. You couldn't escape. You couldn't find freedom. So these people are necessary for people to find their freedoms. And without them, we would never have made it to the West, and we'd never have made it to Australia. And I'm forever grateful to those people.
On Life Matters, our guest is Les Murray, the face and voice of football in Australia. We're talking about Les's life because he's written his autobiography, By the Balls, Memoir of a Football Tragic, and we're just at that point where Les's family is escaping from totalitarian Soviet Hungary into Austria. What was it like to finally cross that border?
Well, it was I'll never forget it, really. We were walking across the border. The man who guided us to the border, he kissed us all and hugged us all and turned back. It was the dead of night. It was in the winter. And so we walked slowly. He just told us to go, continue going in the same direction, and you'll come to a village. And so we walked. It was very quiet. Nobody spoke. The only noise was the crackling of the snow under our feet. We heard some singing in the distance. That was the first sign of life that we encountered. And then we saw some lights, some flickering lights in the distance, but the singing got louder and louder. And when we finally got to these people who were singing, we found that they were a pair of drunks who were staggering home from the local beer keller, you know, late at night. And, of course, they were Austrians. So there was this feeling straight away that we were in a foreign country. that's a very significant feeling that one gets in this kind of circumstance. And then my father started talking to them in German. I always knew my father spoke fluent German, but I never heard him speak German before this. And the guy said, well, who are you? What are you doing here? He said, well, we are refugees from Hungary. We've just escaped from that nasty place. And the big guy slapped my father on the back and started laughing, this howl of laughter. He said, well, welcome, you are free. And that moment I'll never forget.
It is an amazing moment. You refugees in Austria, and you very nearly went to South Africa, but then some time later you found yourself in Australia at the Bongilla migrant camp near Wagga Wagga, and you were new Australians.
That's right. We could have ended up in all sorts of places because the Hungarian refugees were seen as heroes by the Western world. Here's this small country that has stood up against the Soviet tanks. It was a significant moment in the Cold War. So Hungarians were seen as heroes, as not that we were heroes, but we were just refugees, but that's how they were. It was good propaganda for governments to accept Hungarian refugees. It was good politics.
Cold War politics, of
absolutely,
course.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So there was none of this what we have today, closed borders and border protection or any of that stuff. They welcomed us everywhere. And countries actually lobbied with the Hungarians in the various refugee camps in Austria to go to those places. The South Africans set up offices just outside the refugee camp, these sort of mobile prefab offices, just to process immigrants. They actually quite seduced my father with the idea of going to South Africa, because we would have been given a house and a maid, and my father would have got a job straight away and all that stuff. But the rest of the family was dead set against going to South Africa. We wanted to go to America or to Australia. We had relatives in both countries. So basically we put our names down for both and decided that whichever country accepts us first, that's where we're going to go. And the Americans, because most Hungarians wanted to go to the United States, the American processing was very, very slow. And the Australians processed us much quicker. So we became new Australians, as you say.
But, you may have been Cold War heroes, but was it tough life in Australia, in your new home of Wollongong, south of Sydney? It was a real culture shock.
Yeah, I mean, migration, people don't realise how tough it is. And I'm not sure, with my mind and with the benefit of hindsight and all of that, I'm not sure whether I would have done this in 1956, because most people didn't. I mean, most people chose to stay. It's really only a small proportion of people who actually decide to uproot and go to another country, another culture. So you to go to a very foreign culture to your own, different language, different customs, different food, different laws, different everything, different traditions, was a major culture shock. You have to start from scratch. You don't have anything except the clothes on your back. So it's a difficult time, and there's all sorts of trappings in that process. A lot of people, a proportion of people, will get beaten by that, and in fact get homesick and return.
And look, Wollongong in the mid-1950s, a very conservative place.
It was. Well, to be fair, it was boring. I mean, it was not. But kids are kids, and we enjoyed ourselves no matter where we were. But it was, by the time we became teenagers, we really had to move from there, because it was a very, very much a provincial place. It was basically fueled by the steelworks. There was nothing much else there. And not a lovely part of the world, especially today, but it was a conservative place and very much the home of migrants because of the steelworks. The school that I went to, Berkeley High, 60 or 70% of those kids were of non-English-speaking background. It was very much a migrant place.
And your dad was at the steelworks.
Yes.
And you did the classic new migrant boy thing. You threw yourself into your studies. And into football.
Well, I had to. I mean, when I arrived, I knew no English and had no school record that they could rely on. They put me into a class in high school from which, you couldn't become anything. So I had to work doubly hard. I had to swat really hard to make that climb and graduate from high school and basically matriculate from high school. So all I did really in those years between the age of 11 and 18, those 7 years, was to study and play football in the daylight hours whenever I could. You know.
On Life Matters, our guest today is Les Murray, the voice and the face of football in Australia and author of By the Balls memoir. In your late teens, something, well, really devastating happened to an older player who you really looked up to called Imre Kish.
Yes, it was a kind of a turning point in my life. When I was playing, when I was about 17 or 18, and I was playing in an amateur team, this guy was a teammate, and he was another Hungarian, but I kind of idolized him. I kind of looked up to him, and he was about 10 years older than me. He was in his late 20s. He worked at the steelworks in Port Kembla. He was a handsome guy, always well-dressed, always smelled good. The women were chasing him and all those things. And I considered myself his friend. He gave me a lot of good advice about football. And suddenly came this horrible news that he committed suicide, Imre Kish. It was not the sadness of it, but more the shock of it that just totally devastated me at the time, because I just didn't. Life to me was so much fun and so full of joy that I just couldn't understand how and why somebody that rational, who had everything going for him, to my mind, could take his own life. I couldn't understand it.
It threw you into a kind of malaise, didn't it?
It did. It did. To the extent where my mother noticed, and she was very worried about it, and she took me to the doctors, to the doctor, and said, "Well, you know, can you help this boy, because he's got some kind of problem here?" I was just getting ready for my high school graduation exams, and I was supposed to be studying, and I couldn't study. I couldn't concentrate. This thing was just rolling around in my head all the time. I needed to find some kind of solution about the meaning of life and all this kind of stuff. And I started delving into Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus and all these sorts of people and everything. So it was a worrying time, but I solved the problem on my own, because I remember the doctor saying, "Well, look, this stuff is for philosophers, and most of them don't agree with each other anyway." And it's true, they don't.
That's true.
So you have to come up with your own convictions about these things and what they mean. And the conviction that I came up with was that life is a source of joy, and there is no meaning other than your desire to live it, which is, you know, the most powerful instinct, not just in human beings, but in the animal kingdom. So I focused my attentions on things that I enjoyed most. And the most prominent among those was football.
You're obviously passionate about it. What happened to your own playing career?
Well, I never made it as any kind of great player. I would have loved to.
But you had talent.
Maybe even
you
today.
You did have talent.
I think I did. Well, two things happened. One is that my parents, it was a very close-knit European family, and my parents didn't put any of us three boys into a proper organized team. So the football that we played was street football. We went across the road with a ball, and my two brothers and I, and we would play. Other kids joined us sometimes, and so we would have a game and so on. But we were not playing for the Berkeley under-14s,
right.
You know? So by the time I got to be of an age, 17 or 18, where I was trialing for professional clubs, I didn't have real team experience. I had all the technique. I could pass the ball properly, I could trap it properly, I could juggle it, I could do all sorts of things with the ball, but I didn't have that team awareness. So that was one thing. And the other thing was that I was actually offered a contract by a team called Prague, which was then the...
The team
in Sydney. And I was offered a contract with them, and I said I declined it because my childhood dream was to play for a team called Budapest, later to become St. George Budapest. So I trialed for them, and they took me. They did give me a contract, but I suspect that one of the reasons they did was because I was Hungarian, and it was a Hungarian club. So there was no genuine belief as there was with the Prague team, where the coach looked at me and said, hey, this kid's got something, I want to sign him. So when I decided to leave that club, they said, okay,
see,
you know,
yes.
See you later. You know?
We have to leapfrog a bit now, but I have to ask, when did you go from being Laszlo Orge to Les Murray?
Well, that started with my entry into television. The first job I got in television was to commentate on the National Soccer League in 1977, when Channel 10 started a program, a weekly program on the National Soccer League. At the launch of the program at the old Gazebo Hotel in Sydney, in Potts Point, they had a fairly lavish kind of press launch. And the big moment came when to introduce the commentator who was chosen. And he was about to announce my name, which was then Les, U-R-G-E, pronounced Urge in Hungarian, but most people in Australia pronounced it Urge.
Yes.
So Les Urge was my name. And before spitting this out, Peter Skelton stepped down from the podium and he said, Les, your name. We've got to do something about your name. And then I quickly spat out, Les Murray, call me Les Murray. And he jumped up on stage and said, well, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce the commentator for the program, Les Murray.
Your dad had said something to you about
Yeah, that's why I thought of it, because at the time I could have thought of any name, but the reason I spat that out so quickly was because my dad once said that if he ever anglicised his name, it would be Murray, because as Murray, pronounced the Hungarian way, it works as a Hungarian name. So, in fact, I have a Hungarian passport as well as an Australian passport, and on the Hungarian passport, my name is Murray Laszlo, because in Hungary, the surname comes first. Mm. So it's Murray Laszlo. That is my name on my Hungarian passport.
So much has happened since then, and you're very much a central player in the development of football in this country. What was your vision for the game in Australia way back almost 30 years ago?
Well, I guess the vision was that it should be appreciated and valued as it is in the rest of the world. To go back to when we arrived, the culture shock. I mean, I just didn't know at the time when I was 11 years old that there was a country where football was not the number one diversion. My father never warned me about this. I was very angry with him about this. So almost from the moment that I arrived, I guess I was, without knowing it, I was some kind of missionary about this. I used to look with ridicule on people who didn't appreciate football.
We need to wake these people up.
That's exactly right. And I did that in high school with the kids. I argued with them, you know, till the cows came home about how beautiful football was. And they said, no, rugby league is the greatest sport in the world, mate, and all of that. So the missionary work really started from there, and that was the only vision. I wanted Australians to be, well, what's happening today, which is 95,000 people at a game, all Australians, cheering the Socceroos. That was not happening then, and that's what I wanted to see.
The voice of soccer in Australia, SBS TV's Les Murray, and he'll be back on your screens from South Africa through the week. That interview was recorded in 2006 after the release of his autobiography, By the Balls, which is published by Random House. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. And as you've heard, their football really has taken over his life. Don't go away. We're about to meet someone else with a true passion, this time for little penguins.